Well, thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
That was, Amadeo, a short introduction. I'd hate to hear a long introduction. In Australia, we have a saying, which is the bigger the hat, the smaller the property. I often think that means the longer the CV, the less significant the person. It's good to be back in Spain. I love this country. I've been here many times, and I've been to Madrid many times. It's a wonderful country and so much part of the civilization that we call the West, the civilization that we call Europe. I've been told that I can speak for about 20 minutes, so let me put some thoughts before you before we go to, after my friend and colleague Roger Cohen speaks, we then go to a general discourse and discussion. We live in challenging times. Of course, political leaders have been saying that since time immemorial, to the point where the expression challenging times has lost most of its meaning. Those of us who are students of history are much given to efforts to periodize history. That is, when one era starts and another era ends. Also, we know from our studies of history, these things are much more difficult to define when we are in the middle of them, as opposed to when we look backwards in the rear vision mirror, and then we understand everything with absolute clarity, with 20/20 hindsight. We should therefore be cautious about using terms such as historical turning point. We should also be careful even about using softer and more fashionable terms like historical inflection point. But we would be foolish to simply conclude that there are not large changes at play in the world today, because there are, and they affect the post-war liberal international order. The truth is, we face profound challenges. We may be permitted to use the term systemic changes, or even mega changes. Analysing these is one thing, that is hard enough. Understanding where these changes may take us is even harder. But then again, to answer Lenin's great question of what then is to be done, well, that's even harder again. Therefore, the particular challenge of our age is not simply to provide analytical coherence to the great changes unfolding around us. It is also to act. It requires us also to recognise that our political leaders, our policymakers, our corporate elites, our leaders of civil society, and even the academy itself, they are all struggling to cope with the intensity, the density, the complexity of multiple changes occurring at the same time. It is as if we are struggling to find the most elementary torchlight to illuminate what is happening to us, before asking what we should do about it. For now we find ourselves buffeted by the most profound changes driven by an ever-increasing technological revolution, deep changes and challenges to our underlying economic assumptions, the fragmenting of our societies, the fracturing of our traditional politics, the balkanization of public opinion, and the erosion of long-standing values that would normally provide us with a sufficiently robust moral compass to guide us through the morass. All these things are happening simultaneously and with accelerating speed, for which reason it is critical for all women and men who carry in their minds and their hearts the great liberal project of open politics, open economies, and open societies, just to make sense of it all. And then through civilized discourse, chart a way through to the future, which does not allow these great liberal values to be consigned to the ash heap of history. These values have been hard won and hard fought for. We need only to reflect on the modern history of this great country, Spain, to understand that. These are values worth fighting for, and fight we must. Let's talk for a while just about values. I argue that it's important to have a broad view and a long view of history. If modern history begins with the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Enlightenment, then we should make some judgments about where we have reached by now. I find it the absence of public international intellectual curiosity about these subjects quite frightening. It is as if for many of us the past has now indeed become a foreign country. And as a culture, we've become fascinated by the celebration of the moment, or what my Jesuit friends have recently called the globalization of superficiality. Take, for example, the question of the Reformation, whose 500th anniversary we commemorate this year. This was not just a theological debate about the nature of humanity's relationship with its creator. It was a deep debate about the epistemology of knowledge. Should we accept truth as delivered by tradition, or as the Reformers called it, sola scriptura, or from the scriptures alone as directed by a fully informed mind and conscience? Understandably, the Reformation has a disputed historiography, and not just between Catholics and Protestants, but also with Max Weber's equally contested conclusion about the Protestant work ethic, the rise of materialism, and the future of capitalism. My point here is not to reach any profound conclusion on what all this has meant for the evolution of the idea of the West, and more broadly, the liberal global order that has been built on it. My point here is to lament the fact that on this extraordinary 500th anniversary of such a seminal event in Western history, there is barely the faintest murmur of public discussion about it. At a minimum, it was a debate in which the Catholic Church and the Reformers were engaged in about whether we could define objective truth. If so, how could we define objective truth? This lay, for example, at the heart of the rich correspondence between Erasmus and More, the intellectual giants of that age. And so it has been ever since. When the Reformation folded into the Enlightenment several centuries later, the parallel question was whether we could arrive at objective truth through either rationalism of Descartes or empiricism of David Hume. But the uncomfortable truth is that in this second decade of the 21st century, nobody seems to care anymore. It is no longer a question in the tradition of Aquinas, of faith and reason, or in the more modern tradition of the religious skeptics of faith or reason. This has long been a familiar dialectic within the intellectual tradition of the West. But it is as if now we have arrived at a postmodern age where objective truth is no longer accessible by any epistemology. All things are subjective. All things are therefore relative. That my opinion is as valuable as your opinion, irrespective of whether these opinions can be supported by what once we quaintly called facts. So welcome to the terrifying world of social media in which all of us in this room now engage. And welcome to the world of fake news in all of its Orwellian obscenity, whereby those who have deliberately launched campaigns to perpetuate fake news take full advantage of the liberties inherent in our political and intellectual tradition, now accuse those who expose fake news as the perpetrators of fake news themselves. And so we end up in a political system governed by the principles of Alice in Wonderland, where everything is topsy-turvy. And we're not quite sure who is looking through whom at the looking glass. So much so now that we find the liberty of the press not just being undermined by those who lie outside the intellectual and canonical traditions of the West, but now by deep forces from within those traditions as well. Some may argue that this is too philosophical a position from which to begin our conversation this evening. But the reason I raise it at the start is that it's fundamental to any discussion we now have about any question of political and policy importance, both within our countries and between them. Because the absolute core of our Western political tradition is what we once called the pursuit of truth, employing the commonly accepted conceptual tools of Judeo-Christianity, the Enlightenment, to do so. These were our theological and philosophical, our conceptual lingua franca. And my core argument is that unless this foundation stone can once again be laid securely, I fear for the future of the rest of the edifice on which it is now constructed. So much for the challenge of values. What about the challenge of technology? Everyone in this room here is familiar with the contours of the great debate about technology raging across the world today. We're also familiar with Moore's Law, which states that the processing power of computers doubles every 2 years. Just as we share some understanding of the profound breakthroughs in new materials research. But it seems that the great beast of technology, the Leviathan of our age, notwithstanding the enormous virtues it has delivered to civilization, now presents us with a new generation of challenges for all our futures. If, that is, we are to remain anchored in the liberal values for which we have stood. Question number one. Will the technological revolution, turbocharged by its handmaiden international financial capital, now create its own borderless state, which is divided simply into two classes, the owners of technology and capital, and those who own neither? A second question. For those who own neither, what does the prospect of long-term or lifetime unemployment look like as mechanization is transcended by automation, which is in turn transcended by artificial intelligence? And as full-time jobs become part-time jobs, then become casual jobs, and then they become no jobs at all. A third question. When will we reach the threshold of artificial intelligence, or have we crossed that threshold already, where human agency itself is progressively rendered redundant, and when robotics begins to assume the dimensions of the science fictional world we once read about in our childhoods, including on the great questions of life itself? Again, many may find these questions too prosaic to begin our discussion this evening on the future of the liberal order, but I would argue they are deeply germane in terms of the ability of economic, political, and international systems to manage the revolutionary impact of technology in a manner which benefits the many and not just the few. And the ultimate question for us all, namely whether technology is to serve humanity or humanity to serve technology. A third challenge, the destruction of the social and economic contract. Where this leads, that is, the discussion we've just had about technology, is whether our current economic assumptions are any longer socially or politically sustainable if once again the underlying values of the liberal order are to be preserved. One of the core virtues of the liberal order is the belief in the equality of mankind, as well as a belief of equal importance in a minimum level of equality of opportunity, which enables all to make the most of their talents and to be rewarded accordingly. The politics of inequality, as we've seen in previous periods of human history, generate their own dynamic. But when we also see the erosion of equality of opportunity across our liberal order, we lend a fresh intensity to the challenging politics of our already deeply unequal societies. Of course, we are all aware of the history of the social contract in one form or another, under which acceptable levels of equality, of opportunity, and social protection would be provided by both social democratic and liberal states. However, through budgetary pressures alone, this contract began to crack, and to crack deeply. And we see this in mass youth unemployment in many countries, including Spain, over the period since the global financial crisis. It is as if we have not come to grips with the more fundamental internal contradictions of capitalism, particularly when practiced at its extremity. And I speak as a social democrat supportive of the capitalist project. And with the global financial crisis, the challenge was a financial crisis produced by the insatiable demands for financial deregulation that eventually unleashed a monster beyond the regulatory powers of the state, and which came close to consuming us all. And it was only through the collective agency of government, good old-fashioned government, that we were able to intervene at the brink and prevent the global recession of 2008-09 from becoming the second global depression within three quarters of a century. Through the crisis, we encountered a form of capitalism which privatized its profits and socialized its losses. And those who subsidized the losses were the women and men who lost their savings, lost their jobs, and in some cases lost their futures, because the budgets of governments became overwhelmed by the wholesale transfer of private debt to public debt that occurred at this time. We all know Schumpeter's description of capitalism as a process of creative destruction. We have seen capitalism's creative destruction at work in our countries, our economies, and our societies over the last decade. so much so that they might make your average academic Marxist clap for joy. But if brought to the service, the absolute absurdity of Hayek and Friedman and the hypercapitalism that they espoused. When we add this dynamic to the employment-shedding impacts that we now face through the artificial intelligence revolution, we are looking at a set of political tensions within capitalist economies that will stretch our political systems to the absolute limit, possibly to breaking point. Unless the liberal order is able to rebuild a new, credible and financially sustainable economic and social contract with our peoples, as a deliberate break on the destructionism intrinsic to the capitalist order itself, the political fabric underpinning modern capitalism will simply collapse. One further challenge, the failure of politics. Given all the above, how has politics, as we practice it for most of the post-world order, deal with these quantum assaults on equality, opportunity, and employment? The short answer to this question is simple, not well. It is as if we are practicing politics as normal in a world where everything else has now become abnormal. At its heart, however, has been the inability of nation states, and not just those within the liberal order, to manage the impact of neoliberal globalization in a manner which preserves social cohesion and economic opportunity for all. Put bluntly, the challenge now seems to be beyond the capabilities of individual nation states, even the largest, such as America. National politicians will happily make promises about economic growth, employment growth, social provision, while realizing all along that there are now so many policy variables beyond their national control that they have no ability to guarantee whether they can guarantee and deliver these undertakings to the very people who have elected them. And when systemic non-delivery of solemn undertakings to the democratic body politic occurs, either by parties of the traditional centre-left or the centre-right, then a crisis of confidence more broadly occurs with the democratic system itself. So far, I see this crisis unfolding in two stages. The first is what we see at present in so many of our liberal democracies, as voters vacate the centre and head to the extremes of either the far left or the far right. Of course, the rallying cry of the far left, at least at the extremes, is that there are just too many people, and there should be less in my country, not more. As for the politics of the far right, we know its common language, its universal patois, its political war cry. It is race. We see it in America, we see it in Europe, and we see it in my country, Australia. And at its heart is an assault on the deepest of liberal values, open economies, open societies, and open politics, as well as an assault on the liberal international order. And that is where we find ourselves today, although with uncertain landing points for the future. Both in Germany and France, I hear from my friends that we shouldn't be too concerned, because so long as the centre holds, for example, through a continuing grand coalition in Germany, or the second round voting system in the French presidential elections, then it's impossible for the parties of the extreme to assume executive power. This seems to me to be at the same time both profoundly defeatist and profoundly complacent. We all understand the history of these movements and where they can go once they have a purchase on real political power. But what I fear most of all is the second stage of where all this may well go. What happens if the populist right or the populist left does assume executive power? What do they then do with the levers of political office for however long they may be there? But equally importantly, what happens when you get to a point when they turn in disillusion to their populist voter bases, when in office these leaders prove incapable of satisfying demands which are almost by definition incapable of satisfaction in the first place? What will the Trump voters do when Trump cannot deliver on what Trump has said to them? The default position of both the traditional centre-left and the centre-right seems to be that, well, at least the people have finally come to their senses, they've realised the political extremes can't deliver anything of substance, and therefore it's time to come home to us, in the centre-left or the centre-right. I'm not so sure. If by that stage the voting public have become so disillusioned with the full spectrum of their political choices, then do we begin to see the end of the democratic project itself? Of course, we know there are leaders in the world who have reached that conclusion ahead of time. Yet this would be the deepest assault of all on the values underpinning the liberal order. And so as my 20 minutes is now done, what are the future of the liberal international order? We'll come to that in our discussion. But the reason I've spent so much time this evening focusing on our domestic, political, economic and ideational challenges is that unless these things are addressed effectively within our countries, then the future of the liberal international order cannot be addressed effectively either. There is a temptation simply to see the challenges to the liberal international order as lying external to our nations, out there somewhere, in the form of the new authoritarianisms that we have seen in various countries of the world. There's much truth in this. But unless we are also fully seized of the challenges that lie within the liberal international order, starting within our own domestic political orders, then we're not dealing with the core challenge. Core challenges such as, do we actually believe in the idea of the West anymore? And if not the West, do we believe still in the deep inherited values of the liberal order? Do we believe they apply both at home and abroad? Do we believe in objective values of open societies, open economies, and open politics? Are we willing to be active citizens prepared to defend them? Or have we simply disappeared into our own privatised online worlds, lost somewhere between Japanese manga comics, cyber porn, and the balkanised sub-societies of Facebook? I don't know the answer to these, but I do know that unless we have confidence in the defence of these values and the defence of the systems we've constructed around them, both nationally and internationally, there is no hope for our future cause. I look forward to the discussion at some detail on what is now happening in the world between China, the United States, between Russia and the rest of the order, including what's happening here in Europe. But I believe it was important to deal with these domestic questions first because they lie at the core of all of our deliberations in the future. I thank you.